Now, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Cincinnati Life Insurance versus Breyer.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, Mr. Breyer. We're here today, as the court well knows, on a dispute over a life insurance policy and a dispute over a complaint. The life insurance policy, obviously, is one of your concern. And the concerns in that is has to do with the way summary judgment developed and the ruling by the court, as well as the issues associated with discovery, which, in our opinion, are such that they were essentially new evidence and is distinguished from the Ott case. The issues that were before the court in summary judgment did not include whether the consideration for the transfer of the life insurance policy or assignment of the life insurance policy included the second loan. We were still gathering information on that as it was. The issues that were there was whether there was consideration for the first loan, the March 2007 loan. I think the court clearly indicated, and I don't disagree with its opinion, that the insurance was not, the assignment of a policy can't be retroactively granted as consideration for past events. That all being said, the second issue that is, I think, of paramount importance is, when does a motion to consider reconsider a matter of something you should have said earlier in the case and not later on? In this particular instance, it is the burden of the moving party to show where the what's at issue. And they said what was at issue, and we responded to that. We didn't get the discovery relating to the other information, and counsels have gotten along. You know, it wasn't like a testy relationship, so to speak, but we didn't get that until a few days before the court issued his response and came as a surprise to us. And then, of course, we responded, I thought, appropriately in pointing out to the court that it's a decision that the second loan was the, or the reconstituted loan was the, was the basis for the consideration for the assignment, could not have occurred based upon this other testimony that had existed in cases that we weren't privy to, and the testimony occurring primarily in the course of depositions that were never filed.
Well, let me ask you a question about the consideration. You know, there's this phrase in the document that says, for value received. Why isn't that statement sufficient under Illinois law to find consideration for the assignment?
A couple of reasons. The statement, you are allowed to have parole evidence to come in to say whether or not there was, in fact, consideration engaged. Plus, Illinois requires valuable consideration. In this particular instance, we're saying there was no consideration, and none has ever been identified. We went through discovery on this issue.
I'm not tracking why that for value received doesn't equate to the $3 million policy.
Is the issue in terms of whether you stay within the four corners of the issue, or is it?
Yeah, that's one issue, because you usually don't get to parole evidence unless you have to. If it's not clear on its face, if there's some ambiguity, then we might get to parole evidence. But I'm having trouble finding why we even get to that.
Parole evidence would go to information outside of the four corners of the what is being inside the agreement.
Right.
It doesn't go necessarily to the definitions about what happened in the agreement or what was happening there. If it said for value conceived one that received $1, I'm not sure even under Illinois law that would have been sufficient because of the issues associated with the disparity in terms of the amounts. All that aside, though, you can always look at parole evidence rule to create or identify if something, in fact, occurred. And in this instance here, we're saying it never occurred. We never received any consideration for that. And so there was a want of consideration from the beginning, and I think that's the issue that that goes outside of the parole evidence rule. That also being said, there was really no reason for any value received. There was no reason for the assignment of the policy. If with the additional evidence that we uncovered, it was apparent there was the entire the $5 million was collateralized by $1.5 million in cash that was already in the account, which apparently operating income, which was part of the collateral. There was a $2.5 million guarantee by Mr. Savory at the time that was happening, and this goes to another issue too, was not fully executed. There were loan documents that were not fully executed, and there was a dispute going on between Mr. Savory and the bank that was never communicated to my clients, which also goes directly to my client's ability to protect itself. There's side deals going on about the issues associated with the guarantees that will have direct impact upon my client's ability to protect itself in the future. On top of those other three guarantees, now with those three, you're up to $4 million in protections. There was another guarantee personally signed by Mr. Saver, which the bank held on to, for $830,000. And in fact, that has to do, if you recall the information we had in terms of the sale modification or the sale agreement, would also have carried over because it wasn't released by the bank and the buyers were not required to protect Mr. Savory on that issue as well. He was a drafter.
Did Discovery go to the competency of your client?
Say again?
Did the Discovery go to the competency of your client?
In what respect, Your Honor?
Well, you said that shows that he couldn't protect himself.
No. It's protecting himself, but not in terms of competency issues. It was protecting himself in terms of having the securities that he entered into the agreement for. When you come and sit at the table and everybody's at arm's length and you're saying, okay, I'm going to sign myself and I'm going to commit myself to $5 million protections, but I know I've got backing me $2.5 million from Mr. Savory because you, Mr. Banker, said he signed good guarantees, loan guarantees, and there's another $1.5 million in the account. Mr. Banker, you said also that that's good, and there's this other $830,000 that's in the account, plus the issues associated with the matters relating to the various property that's in that they've
Are
taken securities.
Are you saying that it's unlawful to oversecure a loan?
I'm not saying it's unlawful. I'm saying they don't need $3 million. And in this particular instance, there was no meeting of the minds on the issue of whether or not there was going to be over-securing a loan. I think that's the concern there. Plus, aside from the issue in terms of parole evidence, it was never raised before the court. Everybody argued the issue of consideration around the centerpiece of that first loan. So by consent of the parties implicit in everything else, we all were talking about whether or not there was valuable consideration. It was an issue from the moment the case was transferred. And, you know, from that point on, everybody was arguing it. I never once recall one blurb about parole evidence until we get to the Court of Appeals in a responsive brief. So when you look at those issues there, I think the fundamental fact is why would the judge go ahead and rule and issue a secondary issue of consideration that was never briefed, that was never discussed, and was never even on the horizon? And then, of course, if you're going to do that and we just get new evidence, then ought you not let us have a second chance to bring that new evidence forward, especially since it was evidence that was not in our control, not accessible.
What evidence was not accessible?
There were depositions. What would happen here was this.
Where were the depositions?
They were in a previous case in which my clients were not invited to.
And you couldn't buy the transcripts of the
transcripts were not filed. I couldn't find the court reporter. I went and we got the other documents, but I couldn't find the court reporter.
So in that state court litigation, she was not a party to that litigation?
If she was a party to the litigation, it was before bankruptcy. And after bankruptcy occurred, she didn't get any notices about what was going on or what depositions are done. I couldn't even understand why they didn't depose her in their battles.
But so you're saying she was not a party to that state court?
She was not at the time of those depositions. Not in 2009, 2010. There was another case, I think, in 2010, 2011, that involved the Mr. Savory and whether or not there was fraudulent conveyance of assets. We didn't even know about it until Mr. Grotenhouse's attorney revealed it to us, which was no problem. I'm not alleging any concealment or anything like that. We were looking for the affidavits. We did go ahead and get a lot of documents from Ford, found out things that Mr. Grotenhouse didn't know.
Well, that case, though, that CSB case, I just want to make sure we're talking about the same lawsuit. That was filed in Illinois State Court, and that happened in 2008. And that was against both of them for failure to make
payments. But what happened in December 24th, 2008, the buyers were discharged in bankruptcy. Before that, in September 2008, the automatic stay kicked in. So from that point on, they're not being involved, and they weren't invited to it. And afterwards, when the depositions were being taken in 2009, 2008, 2010, they were not invited to say, hey, they didn't receive a notice in the mail, say, hey, come on. They're out of the picture because they've been discharged in bankruptcy. And I think that was a reasonable thing that most attorneys would do. These folks are out. We're just going to keep it amongst ourselves. But when it came time for us to get this information, when it became pertinent, we did have the issues regarding the case was there. But in fact, I personally drove up there. And I went and I talked to various court reporters that were there for the court. Who did the depositions? Where are the depositions? No one could tell me. It was an issue of discovery between myself and opposing counsel. We resolved those issues shortly before the judge issued his decision. In fact, the judge called the day before, as he indicated, is discovery resolved. What I actually said was, Your Honor, I've got this stuff. I'm starting to wade through it. I think we've got everything, and we should be able to get something going. But before I could do anything, that issue got taken care of. The court basically made a ruling. Then on top of that, we have the secondary issue about what happened with the rider. And that's an issue that was never briefed by anybody. It was whether that rider was going to have any value or not was dependent upon whether or not Mr. Grotenhouse got the policy. Once he got the policy, then there was an issue about the rider as a practical matter. Before that, when Mrs. Byers was alive, the issue about that rider was important, too, to him. But if Mrs. Byers got the whole policy, then there was really nothing to complain about in terms of whether or not that insurance rider should apply. That was an alternative argument. Does that make any sense?
Anyway. Yeah. There is one thing that I found. Is the Third Amended answer and cross-claim? What we're arguing about?
That's there? What we're arguing about that's in there. But that was included from the very beginning. That was in part of the very beginning. It went through various stages.
But it's difficult for me to distinguish between what is a statement of fact and what appears to be an argument. It's rare in federal court to see these very long paragraphs.
There were several.
And I really found it difficult to find out what you were alleging as fact and what you were arguing.
And if those three paragraphs were thrown out, I think the remainder of the complaint was sufficient for everybody. We did discovery. We did depositions.
I just picked those three as random.
Well, there are others in there. Most of them are within a few sentences, and they try to be compliant. I mean, I will not. If the court was offended by those three paragraphs, I think those were the ones which the trial court stated they could have taken those paragraphs out, and I think we still would have been surprised, would have been satisfied, because those were basically an attempt to overview. If it was inarticulately drawn, I think the proper remedy is to remove those three and take the others. But then on the flip issue, there was one other matter. Once the new discovery came in, should we have been able to come back for another bite of the apple with this new information? Because quite honestly, up to that point, there's allegations in that complaint which I would not want to stand by in light of the new evidence that I received. But by that time, a lot of things had transpired.
Well, let me ask you one other question about this suit filed in 2008 by CSB. Were the only defendants the buyers?
I believe if it's the same suit, that the other defendants would have been Mr. Saver. And so what you had in 2008, you had Casey State Bank foreclosing and calling in the loans. Casey State Bank then went to collect on the loans, and they filed against Mr. Savory and the buyers. Buyers went ahead and filed bankruptcy. Now it's just Mr. Savory, Mr. Grotenhaus, and Casey State Bank trying to collect. And I see I'm out of time, but if I may finish my sentence. Then you go to September. Mrs. Byers is in bankruptcy. At that point there, she's now out of the picture when she gets discharged in December, as is Mr. Byers. And so they continue to battle it out amongst themselves over the intervening years. They have depositions. The depositions are agreed to counsel. Notices aren't filed identifying who the court reporter is. I go to try to get the material. The depositions, which are the predominant information that was in the September 2011 letter from the opposing counsel, at that point there was the first time we get to see these depositions, and there's even reference in that letter to an additional deposition or two. This with a court reporter that gets identified for the same time. So up to that point there, I don't have this key information, and this key information tells me loans were never signed to begin with, that the guarantees were a mess, that there was never any issue regarding restructuring the loans until November, December, and that was largely brought upon a concern about fear of buyers and turning around and suing. So at that point there, you have an insurance policy that's in a vacuum, and everybody's agreeing to talk about the issue regarding consideration, although I think it's outside the parole principle. I think you can look at it. But that being said, everybody was there. So, if I may. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Meyer?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is James Richard Myers from Vandalia, Illinois, and I represent two of the appellees in this case, Stanton Grotenhaus and Casey State Bank. I'd like to jump in and just address the issues of consideration. Like Ms. Byers' counsel, I believe that the important issue for Mr. Grotenhaus is the who is entitled to this $3 million in the policy. And if you look at how that came about, Stanton Grotenhaus filed a motion for summary judgment asking for the entirety of that policy, the whole $3 million that had been interpled by Cincinnati Life. In response to that, Ms. Byer filed an opposition motion that stated some Indiana laws that she believed prohibited the assignment, some Indiana laws that she believed didn't allow the assignment of policies when widows were involved, and tangentially mentioned consideration. In fact, when Judge McKinney reviewed, and in his order, he had put the argument as inferred, that Ms. Byer had inferred an argument on consideration when he addressed it. Mrs. Byer also filed her own motion seeking the entirety of the policy, the whole $3 million, based on the Indiana statutes. Stanton Grotenhaus filed a response in opposition addressing the main argument raised, which was the Indiana statutes, Indiana law that prevented the assignments, didn't address the consideration issue, because it was implicitly raised, wasn't hardly argued, very small part of the brief. I got the exact figures in my brief. Judge McKinney goes on to analyze it. He analyzes the Indiana law. He analyzes the implied consideration argument and determines that it's no good. I don't think it's genuine for Mrs. Byer to say that the court did that sua sponte, because she raised it, although implicitly she raised it. Of course, everyone knew there were summary judgment motions pending for the entire $3 million. And so the court analyzes that and awards the whole policy to Stan Grotenhaus. The assignment itself, in the analysis of Judge McKinney, recites that it's for value received. And under Illinois law, that is sufficient. You can't go into parole evidence to set aside that between the parties just to void the instrument, which is exactly what they're trying to do. Judge McKinney went a step further although I don't think he had to, but he went a step further and analyzed and said there actually is consideration in this case, twofold. One was sitting on the rights. Casey State Bank sat on its rights, perhaps, in order to enforce those loans. And then certainly as of the refinance, the restructure in September, I don't remember the exact date, they refinanced and restructured these loans, and they didn't have to do that. So after that point, there surely is consideration for the assignment. And that's just McKinney's analysis. That's not something Stanton Grotenheist said. Again, he didn't address those issues in his briefs at all. Then you go on to the next argument that's raised is this disability rider. And the disability rider basically wants some of the $3 million pie under a different theory. And Judge McKinney, when he analyzed that, said that was waived. And he said that was waived because Stanton Grotenheist asked for the whole $3 million. Mrs. Beyer asked for the whole $3 million. I awarded the whole $3 million, and now you're coming back in, and you want a piece of the $3 million that I already decided goes to Mr. Grotenheist. You should have raised that before, and I think that Judge McKinney was correct in that. Beyond that, it's clear from the face of that rider and the policy that's in the record that it's not a disability benefit regardless. It's an advanced payment of a death benefit, and they're completely different. And if that issue is briefed, I don't think it would. I don't think the outcome would change. The other issue that's big and was raised by Mrs. Beyer is this motion to reconsider and the discovery aspects of that. Once Mr. Grotenheist was awarded the $3 million of the policy, there were two motions to reconsider filed. One was filed immediately, and that was this disability waiver argument that we're entitled to a small portion of the $3 million because of this disability benefit exclusion. No other issues were addressed in that one. Later, there was another one filed that had claims of newly discovered facts, had claims of evidence withheld, and things like that. And Judge McKinney properly analyzed that one as well, and in his discretion denied it, because Rule 59 requires more than what Mrs. Beyer did. She had to show newly discovered evidence or manifest error of law or fact, and she did neither. Both in that motion and in her brief to this court, recites a litany of allegations and things that she believes may be important, doesn't say why they're important, and doesn't cite any part of the record to let us know where those allegations come from. So there's no showing that those facts even matter. And then, more importantly, there's no showing that those facts weren't available. And we go through that in our brief. And the majority of those facts are from that case, the 08 CH10 or whatever it is, Casey State Bank case. I was involved in that case. I can tell you that there was a confession of judgment in that case in March of 2008 against Mr. Beyer, Mrs. Beyer, Mr. Savory, and two or three corporations that Mr. Beyer owned, all of whom had judgments confessed against them. And that was in March of 2008. And then after the confessions of judgment, assets were liquidated. Mrs. Beyer's bank account was liquidated. Mr. Beyer's bank account was liquidated. The corporation's bank accounts were liquidated, all liquidated in that case, and they started to liquidate the assets of the automobile dealerships, which these were. That went on. Mr. and Mrs. Beyer got notice of those things. Mr. and Mrs. Beyer came in on a citation to discover assets before they filed bankruptcy. They did file bankruptcy in September, but at that point, there were judgments against them. We had already liquidated all their property. There was other property being liquidated, but they had no interest in it. And so once they filed bankruptcy, I'm not sure they did get notice of any further proceedings, but I'm not sure they were entitled to notice. What I do know is
what further proceedings were there?
These were automobile dealerships and some real estate leases and who was entitled to income. And there was a dispute between Ford and Mr. Savory and Casey State Bank as to who was entitled to certain vehicles and things like that, and what we basically had an agreement that Ford could liquidate them and pay out the money that they got. But those vehicles belonged to corporations. To the extent the corporations got notice, my recollection is all the addresses turned up to be bad. But the corporations got notice when their assets were liquidated, as Mr. and Mrs. Beyer got notice when their assets were liquidated. But that case wound up pretty quick after that. But the point is that Mrs. Beyer and Mr. Beyer both knew that that case was ongoing. And, you know, in fact, that's how their attorney learned about it. And so whether or not they got notice, they knew it was there. If when Mr. Shaysh was hired or when he came to Illinois to find that case, he knew it was there. He read the record. It's public record. You can go down to the courthouse and look at it. The depositions, I don't believe, were filed, but there's no mystery who court reporters are. They put their initials down. And then if he's determined that depositions were taken in April of 2011, I guess it would have been, he could have called me and asked me. He could have called the other party and asked them. He didn't do any of those things. He didn't ask me for those depositions then. He didn't ask for any depositions until it would have been August, late July or August, when he filed for discovery and asked for all the documents. And then it wasn't within the exact period. I think you get 28 days or 30 days, but within 8 days of the discovery cutoff and within 8 days of the date we had to respond to those things, he had them. And if he had called me in April, he would have had them then. Or at least I could have told him who the court reporter was, and he could have gone and ordered a copy of the transcript. You know, these things aren't hard. And to say that Casey State Bank or Stan Grotenheis impeded discovery is almost out of line, in the sense that he had months and months and months and months to do discovery, didn't do anything till 2 months after a discovery cutoff was entered. That was in late May. This discovery cutoff entered of September 1st. 2 months after that, he didn't do anything. We got our first discovery 2 months after the discovery cutoff was established and 30 days before it was over. And yeah, that's not our fault. And then to say that perhaps an eight-day delay in getting that stuff to him after all that is hardly something that you can go back to court and cry that I didn't have the information. I see my time is up, so unless there's questions, I'll yield the rest of my time to the co-counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Uppenkamp?
Yes, Your Honor. Counsel, I represent Mr. Savory in this matter, and I will be just addressing the fact that the district court dismissed all claims against Mr. Savory under Rule 8, Rule 10, and then in addition to that, made an alternative finding that the complaint did not, the Third Amendment complaint did not comply with the heightened pleading requirement of Rule 9 for all fraud-based claims. I think this court need look no further than its decision from 2011 in Standard v. I think it's Wren. This court held in that case specifically that where a lack of organization and basic coherence renders a complaint too confusing to determine the facts that constitute the alleged wrongful conduct, dismissal is an appropriate remedy. The court in that case dismissed that complaint. It was a Third Amendment complaint as well, I believe, under Rule 8 and Rule 10. That court went on to say that a federal court is not obligated to sift through a complaint to extract some merit when an attorney who drafted it has failed to do so himself. Counsel says, as Your Honor pointed out, held up the complaint, says, well, these aren't short, plain statements. These aren't limited to a single set of facts. And counsel said, well, that's only a couple of paragraphs. That's not true at all. More than half of the paragraphs are that way. If you were to hold this up, you could flip through and see nearly every page has paragraphs that look like that. That would be nearly impossible to respond to if Mr. Savory wanted to respond to a specific complaint. For instance, if you look at a specific claim in the complaint, if the court were to look at paragraph 43, for instance, it makes claims, allegations, I guess, against Mr. Savory. It makes allegations against Casey State Bank. It makes allegations relating to the first loan. It makes allegations relating to the second loan. And that's just in paragraph 43 of the second claim for relief, which spans half a page. Paragraph 44 does that. Paragraph 45 does that. Your Honor pointed to paragraph 7 and 8. We could go on and on through that. This Third Amendment complaint simply does not comply with Rule 8, Rule 10, the spirit of those rules whatsoever. With regard to Rule 9, there is a heightened pleading requirement for fraud-based claims. Case law has determined that you're supposed to tell the what, the why, the when, and Mrs. Beyer's complaint simply didn't do that either. Paragraph 125 of the complaint is a good example. And that would be paragraph 125 on page 31. There is another paragraph 125, as it's misnumbered, which would be on page 27. But the paragraph on page 125, which is a fraud-based claim, which is promissory estoppel or unjust enrichment, says CSB and or Mr. Savory made the promise to Mrs. and or Mrs. Beyer. Well, if we're going to tell who did what, was it CSB or Mr. Savory that made the promise? In a fraud-based claim, you have to make a specific statement. Who did that person make it to? Was it Mr. Beyer or was it Mrs. Beyer? It doesn't tell where. It doesn't tell when either. And that's just an example. Those and ors are spread throughout the fraud-based claims, and the court properly dismissed the case, the entire all claims against Mr. Savory, both fraud-based and not fraud-based, in accordance with Rule 8 and Rule 10. Counsel in his brief says, oh, this isn't nearly as bad as the complaint was in Standard. First of all, counsel's wrong when he says that the complaint in Standard was a 155-page, 400-paragraph complaint. That's not true. It was a 28-count, 52-page complaint. If you look at this particular Third Amendment complaint and you account for all of the claims against all of the defendants, this would be a 29-count, 33, 34-page complaint. Actually, it's very comparable. I would suggest, and I believe that the court properly dismissed the claims against Mr. Savory, the first claim for relief, the second claim for relief, and all fraud-based claims pursuant to Standard and Rule 8, Rule 9, and Rule 10. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case will be taken under advisement. Oh, I'm sorry, we have a rebuttal. Yeah. You have about a minute.
All right, real quickly.
You have no time. I'll give you about a minute.
All right, real quickly. If you look at Doc 154, first page, it clearly states that the information which is being brought in, depositions of various parties from 2009 and the court reporter. Fact is, May 27th is when discovery started. We got into discovery. Demands went out. Sufficient times compiled came in. Court was on alert that there was discovery issues going on between the parties. Similarly, with summary judgment, the issue regarding consideration was raised in the affidavit of Mr. Wolf, which was referred to in Mr. Grodenhouse's motion for summary judgment, which expanded upon issues that were actually in that motion, and that motion only contained issues relating to whether or not there was a security interest in the issue associated with the assignment, and whether or not that was protected under the security agreement that preexisted. And if you look into Mr. Wolf's affidavit, the only thing that he had there, quite honestly, was May loan. I see that I'm out of my time. I would submit, Your Honors, that I'm out of my time. I understand that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Now the case will be taken under advisement.